Hello, this is Patrick from The Fundamental Principle. I'm here with Arno. Welcome back.
Yes, thank you. Glad to be here and hopefully have another fruitful discussion.
I'm sure we will. Jerome's going to be coming in late. I think he's dealing with some other issues. But yeah, no, I didn't want to let the audience wait too long with our discussion about, Pope John Paul and Polish Messianism. So I really wanted to start our conversation with, like, what are your thoughts so far? Leo's been in, was coordinated, what, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, recording, as we're recording?
Yeah, I'd say May 8th, right, I believe is the exact date when he was consecrated to the papal office. And then, just in terms of, you know, what can we expect from this new papacy? I guess the thing I wanted to note, at least off the bat, was I just found it really surprising. I guess it's to say it in a nice way, just in terms of how, you know, you had the Trad Inc., what we'll call them. I'm not sure if that's a perfect name for them, but in terms of, you know, you have the Taylor Marshalls, the Kennedy Halls, the Nick Cavazos, you know, all those guys in terms of, you know, and the biggest telling thing is, like, you have Taylor Marshall, who literally the day before Leo the 14th was elected, you know, he had this video, which is now taken down, in terms of, okay, these are the worst three possible popes who are liberal or who could be liberal. And so he named Tagle, Prevost, and then I believe one other prelate. And then as soon as Leo is selected to be the Pope, that video is no longer available. And then obviously we have his hot take in terms of how he accepts Leo the 14th as his Pope, even though the day before he was literally saying, like, this could be really bad because he's going to be liberal. And here's the reasons why. And so in that regard, I mean, that's more or less what we're getting. I don't think we're going to get a big return to tradition as many of us are longing for at this point.
But Arno, he has Latin in his Twitter bio.
Right. I know. Yeah, exactly. I think that's the point, is like the traditional movement has been making waves. For the good. And obviously you have to be asinine if you don't see that. So of course he's going to, quote unquote, throw us a bone in terms of, like, okay, here's your Latin. I pray in Latin. I speak in Latin. You know, I came out with a wonderful papal cross with the relics of St. Augustine, St. Monica, all these, you know, seemingly nice, good things that you would want from a Pope. But how does that change their methods? You know, is it going to be a reversion of Vatican II and a cancellation of all that? Or is he going to dive head in? And, I mean, we literally got that the day of. He said, yo, I'm going to follow in the footsteps of Francis. We're going to continue the synodality. And so maybe it might be a new flavor of synodality. You know, right? That's a very non-encompassing term. It could mean anything, but essentially it just means progress. So is it going to be the fast progress that we were seeing under Francis, or is it going to be like a slow progress that takes, you know, maybe 5 years, 10 years, etc.? So I think that's more or less the flavor we're going to get. We're going to still get Vatican II shoved down our throats, and I think he's going to throw us a bone to some of the traditional people, or who are the people who are attached to the old mass. Like, hey, I like the old mass. You can stay with it, but I'm going to still just keep plowing forward. You know, this is the new way of the church, the new Catholic humanism, as it were, you know, in terms of this anthropomorphic turn. You know, we're no longer facing God. We're looking at man. Man is the center of creation. That's the ultimate creation of God, right? That's the kind of the new ecclesiology that we see with Vatican II. And again, we see that with the Mass. We see that with all of the sacraments, and none of that's going anywhere. It needs to be a huge, you know, you have to have literally declaring ex cathedra from the chair. I condemn Vatican II. I condemn all of what the previous popes have done up until 1958. But yeah, we're not getting that.
Well, I mean, I think it would even be okay with like the condemnation of liberalism, and just kind of a clarification of like, hey, you know, I'm of the perspective that you can read the Vatican II documents through an illiberal lens as much, you know, use your imagination of like, what would a medieval monk see this as? How would they understand it? How would they, I think it's possible. But I think there needs to be a condemnation of like that. What has been done in sake of the religion of liberalism. So I think that is an issue. I did want to ask you though. Like we just saw Charlotte, North Carolina lose their Latin Mass. Where do you think the bones are going to come into, or Pope Leo is going to help like the normie trads? Or at least just cut people off from the... Well, he has to undercut the SSPX or undercut Sedevacantis. Do you think that's going to happen? Or where do you think the assistance of the normie trad is going to come in?
Yeah, I think in that regards, it's going to be potentially a further reduction in the Latin masses that we're seeing. And Charlotte is, you know, case in point number one. You know, essentially they're removing their diocesan Latin masses. And then I think the biggest thing to my chagrin is that the church, if we want to even call it that, was up until 2 weeks ago being used for Protestant services. So are they going to reconsecrate the church? You know, because we're going to have the Holy Sacrifice and the Mass there. Did we just kick out the Protestants? Or are they still going to have Protestant services there. there's some big issues there. And then, yeah, like I said, in terms of just how are they going to throw a bone to the normie trads, you know, who just, they're just attached to the traditional mass. It's beautiful. You know, it's very transcendent. It's otherworldly, right? But there's a whole other aspect of the faith behind it. And so I think that's where he's going to go. It's like, you can have your mass, but this is going to be the faith moving forward. And obviously they're very incongruous, you know, in terms of one definitely worshiping God, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost. And the other one is, you know, turned around with the priest facing you and, you know, hey, let's hold hands together, sing Kumbaya. Let's worship in community together because man is the utmost important thing that God has created, you know. So, again, he's still going to continue on in that regards of the faith, unfortunately. And so are people going to accept that? I think that's kind of going to be the line in the sand, as it were. Okay, he's not condemning my mass, and we'll continue. And I think that's kind of where the SSPX is. You know, they've obviously softened their stance here in the last 10 plus years, you know, in terms of, you know, they're very condemnatory up until, I think, you know, Benedict XVI kind of threw them a bone like, hey, Summorum Pontificum, you can now say the traditional Latin mass in the diocese, et cetera. Like that was a step forward and a good one. You know, of course, there's a lot of people who became aware of tradition through that. But again, the Vatican still move forward with their progressive agenda and nothing really changed from the faith. It's just like you can hold two contrary ideologies and they can still be okay. And that's, again, that's Vatican II. That's the basics of their understanding of human dignity. You know, it's all about your freedom to choose. And I cannot impose upon that freedom because freedom is the ultimate thing in the Vatican II Church. How dare you impose upon freedom? That is the biggest sin.
I guess that kind of could tie into our next topic. So I wanted to have you on really to mainly talk about, John Paul II, and then the Polish Messianism, and maybe we can tie into like Kabbalic, the Kabbalism, at a later date. But I guess where would you like to start with John Paul?
Yeah, I mean, we could even just go back to his early seminary days, So obviously, so he was a prelate who was trying to fuse together two opposing ideologies, to make them into a new sort of version of Catholicism, right? So John Paul II, he was trying to fuse Kant with Thomism. And so we know in 1948, when he was sent to Rome for his studies, he received the condemnation by the very highly regarded Thomistic theologian, Father Guérigou Lagrange. And he was just saying, dude, your understanding of the faith is not compatible with Catholicism. And so he was essentially kicked out of his Roman studies, and then he ended up finishing his studies back at the University of Krakow, in terms of gaining his priestly order.
Now, was
And
this,
so,
do you remember the year that was off the top of your head?
yeah, it was 1948. Was when this condemnation, and so again, he was rejected by Lagrange, but then he went back to Krakow, University of Krakow in Poland, and that's where he was ordained.
So, but
And so,
we can assume that like the university was run by USSR approved officials.
yeah, it had to at some point, because obviously, yeah, Poland was under USSR control at that time. And that was actually the next thread I wanted to jump into in terms of like, so obviously, like he became a priest. And so, there came a time when they needed to appoint a new bishop. And so at this time, this is also part of like the Ostpolitik in terms of the way Paul VI was kind of dealing with, the communist control of Eastern Europe. How can we get along to get along, so to say. And so John Paul II was also chosen to be a bishop because he wasn't going to be as condemnatory of communism as some of the other priests, or even some of the other prelates in that regards too. So he was already kind of, I don't want to say like double dealing, but he was fine with it. Like, you do your thing, I'll do my thing. I'm not going to condemn you because obviously you're controlling my country. But we'll just kind of work, obviously not side by side, but just in terms of in the same region. And I'm not going to condemn you because obviously if I condemn you, you'll get mad at me and yada yada, just to put it into very layman's terms. And so obviously there we had some cardinals in Poland at the time, like Cardinal Wyszyński is, I think, is the big name in terms of a very conservative Catholic, conservative Polish Catholic. He was very condemnatory of communism at that time. And so, again, it was the communist rulers who had that influence in terms of like, okay, you know what? I don't want Cardinal Wyszyński to have a big role. I want someone who's going to take it easy on us, so to say. And so, again, that's where Cardinal Wojtyla kind of filled that void. He wasn't condemnatory, and he was actually seemingly getting along. Like the Cardinal Wyszyński, for instance, he couldn't even leave Poland. But John Paul II, he had carte blanche, so to say, in terms of being able to go in and out of Poland as much as he pleased. why? That's questions that I think remain to be answered. But it's just, you know, there was a friendliness, I guess, in that regards, that, yeah, John Paul II isn't, or Wojtyla isn't going to condemn us, and we'll let him do what he wants.
Well, that is quite a lot. Something that I wasn't too familiar with. I didn't realize that. I guess I should have thought of that. It was you had to have a travel passport or travel visa to go to and from occupied USSR territory, satellite states. That is interesting. And that definitely leaves some more questions than answers.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, what deals were made? Why isn't John? I mean, and then that's the point. You know, he's touted as this strong anti-communist pope. You know, he and Reagan defeated communism, but did they really? And I would argue no, because obviously communism took a different form, you know, especially here in the United States, in terms of how all of our universities, higher levels of government became ran by leftist ideologues, you know, in that regards. And even within the Vatican itself, in terms of how many people who are open to a globalist understanding of approaching the world.
So, but like, global, so I think we need to kind of define terms. As a Catholics, we should be universalists. We should be like a spiritual globalist, if that makes sense. Like, it's, we're all united under God because we're all made by God. In the spiritual sense, that doesn't equate like the material sense, that, you know, a European is not going to ever be the same as a somebody from China or some from, you know, sub-Saharan Africa. That just, we're two different, you know, three different material objects, but we're still all united through God, through Christ's sacrifice. That doesn't mean that we're internationally, materially the same. I think that's a rather point that we miss. I think that a big fear of mine, and it looks like it's going to continue, is that the lines between spiritual and material are going to blend, and it looks like the current Vatican cares a lot more about the material universalism than anything spiritual. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree in that sense. Yeah, we are a universal religion in terms of being a whole, and that does apply to all men, but our material differences still exist in this life. And so trying to force everyone into the same, you know, level of material differences and saying we're all the same, we're all equal, is a lie. Because obviously we get all of our goods in terms of our talents, our intelligence, our physical capabilities, those all come from God. There is no way to make our material goods equal in that regards. And that's essentially where communism and globalism are at, essentially. Like, let's make all of the material goods the same, and then we will live in this fake utopia. But obviously that's an injustice to the people who have built civilization, who have obviously developed it, who have the intellectual capacity to get it to this point. But that's not how, yeah, the current Vatican sees it. That's obviously not how the world sees it, you know, because it's white supremacy in terms of the origination of Western thought. You know, it comes from Europe, but that's "quote unquote" racist, according to the globalists. You know, it's not equal. Everyone needs to have their equal say, but Is that how civilizations are made? Is that how the church was made? No, you know, that requires a very strict and distinct hierarchical way of governance. And the Catholic Church has done that. And we had kings and queens and princes, and we had all of that. But now we live in a quote unquote democratic world where everyone, regardless of where you're from, should have an equal say, even if what they're saying does not coincide with the, you know, what we'll say, the populace at large. You know, it's meant to subvert, you know, certain populations. And again, that's the West, and that's where we're at.
Yeah, definitely. The democracy of hell, and then the monarchy of heaven is more stark than ever. But it is, you know, it still is quite a shocking to me. It's really disheartening that, you know, telling people not to sin or to be responsible or, you know, just follow the Ten Commandments is a form of white supremacy. You know, telling somebody to be better, to do better, is white supremacy. It's just the state of the world we're in. But you know, we kind of touched on it a little bit. But do you have anything more before we continue? Do you have anything more to say about John Paul?
Yeah, I think there's just one other aspect I really wanted to kind of bring up was just in terms of his book, Person and Action, which he wrote as Cardinal Wojtyla in 1969. And so it was looking at, you know, phenomenological methods, you know, and looking at it sort of with a Thomistic philosophy as best as he could. But again, his understanding was about consciousness and how do you experience the faith? And so he was actually, I would think, very intellectually honest in regards to the end points of this book. And so I just wanted to highlight some of his theses he had in this book. So one of them was thesis number 15. He says, God is not a historical being who works with man, and man does not cooperate with God, but only acts in cooperation with other men. Religion doesn't take its origins from divine revelation, but is simply the result of human imagination. The Catholic religion is no different from other cults. This is thesis number 15. You know, he says in thesis number 16, divine revelation is impossible to prove. Thesis number 17, he says, the only real significance of the New Testament is found in philosophical explanations. He'll say in thesis number 18, each divine mystery is considered as a variation or a nuance of a system of pure thought. And so therefore, traditional dogmatic Christianity is one of these erroneous systems in terms of reducing everything to dogma. I mean, do you want me to keep going? This goes up to, I got like five more.
We can kind of go through them. Sure.
Yeah. So thesis number one, he'll say, 21, he'll say, a purely human community, united and universal. This is the true Christian church according to the meaning of the gospel, understood in a new way, quite contrary to the existing totalitarian church. Thesis number 22, he'll say, the principles of dialogue and neighbor are those which lead to the salvation of Christianity, not the revelation of creation, redemption, or the universal judgment. So I guess, and the big one is, I want to say thesis number 35. It says, man is the visible God. To see man is to see God. And so that just kind of highlights this anthropomorphic turn in terms of how the new ecclesiology likes to highlight that, you know, God is found in man and man's experience. And so again, this is why we get this dialoguing that we get in the modern era, because that's a way for all of these human experiences to interact with each other. And through this dialogue, we will bring about a new understanding. Is essentially kind of how they're understanding things. So it's almost a complete denial of who Christ was, who his church was, and then what the church even is. To them, it's just a human instrument that maybe at a point in time brought order. But obviously, as we see, there's all this divisions, there's Protestants, there's Mormons, there's Catholics, there's every different denomination, there's Hindus. You know, they're all different. And so we must dialogue. We mustn't convert, because dogma is contrary to the human experience. And so this is very Kabbalistic in a certain sense, that where you can have contrary opinions and they can still be true. That's the point. You know, there is no logic anymore in terms of the theory of non-contradiction. Contradictory things are okay now. Because again, it comes back to human dignity and freedom is the big point there. So
I used to be really into like conspiracy theories and I like the show Mysterious Universe, and they would talk about like the New Age religion and abductions, and they always kind of make a point like that the alien abductions always seem demonic. You had to like consent to it to some degree. You always had to put yourself out there like in a weird mental state to some degree. And that was the recurring themes to these abduction stories. But then these people would come back and always be about like true love and happiness. And it's just, it'll be okay, man. It's just, you know, all is love. And it really like when you kind of read these things off, that's what I'm hearing. In my mind, it's just, you know, everything's going to be okay. Everything's, you know, it's just, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, bro. It's just where it's all peace and love and happiness is the only thing that we have to strive for. It really is. I wasn't aware of this list. Like this is all kind of new information for me. But it really is kind of disheartening, that this man kind of set the last 60 years, how much theology's changed because of him.
Yeah, and everyone has essentially gone along with it because it's very human in that sense, where, you know, you're like the argument is that, oh, you're coming alongside them for this journey. You don't necessarily know where people are going or how they're going to get there. It's just nice, right? You don't have to get mean about it. You don't have to condemn them. And yeah, that's essentially where we're at. You know, the truth is obviously subjective in that sense.
Well, yeah, and I think this kind of goes back to people just need to be told what to believe in. Like they could, you know, if as Queen Isabella, if she taught us anything, it's, morality is set by rules. Morality, the law set morality. You know, I which gives me hope for the future. I this may be a little delusional on my part, but I feel like somebody, illiberal, or maybe even a, we'll go with a liberal pontiff could come along and turn the ship around and turn it into a better direction, away from peace, love, and the peace, the material peace, love, and happiness. But I like to, you know, as we've kind of alluded to, would you kind of describe what is Polish Messianism, and how does that relate to John Paul?
Yeah, so Polish Messianism, and we still see a bit of that today, especially with John Paul II, in terms of him being this Polish Messiah person. The thought was that Poland was going to become the Christ of Europe, is essentially how they term it. And so how this ideology kind of came about, it started early on, maybe around like, well, maybe not early on, I'll just say like, so it happened after the November uprisings in Poland, which happened from 1830 to 1831. And so it was a coin, a term that was coined by J.M. Hohen Runkes. And so essentially a way to put it was that faith is so strongly linked with patriotic feelings that sometimes it was difficult to distinguish what the goal and what was the means. And so what we see here is that Poland, through this revolutionary period, you know, they were partitioned into three separate areas. I think they're conquered by Austria, Lithuania, and Russia at the time. So they had many years of defeats, 40 years of partitions, and then there was the Napoleonic Wars that further broke up the country.
So if you go back and listen to our show with the great Dr. Michael Raphael Johnson, he talks a lot about, you know, how, you know, Polish women and Polish peasants were kidnapped and brought into like pubs and, you know, well, I guess pubs would have been more like prostitution houses at the time in medieval Europe. But it was how used and abused to pay off debts of usury that for whatever reason the Polish peasant was tied into. So I'm sure there was a lot of, you know, still Jewish occupation, even be it the more mercantile occupation, not necessarily, you know, militaristic or authoritative, but still that I'm sure that has a, as we see in America, it's quite, it really messes up one's psyche, being ruled by, you know, synagogue of Satan.
Yep, exactly. And so leaving off, so there was just, like you're alluding to, there's just massive suffering that was happening throughout Poland. And so essentially the Poles equated their suffering and their situation to that of our Lord in terms of his suffering that he experienced on Golgotha. So they believed in the complete similarity of their situation between Christ and Poland as it was going on. And so this Polish messianism is this essentially the condition of the resurrection, you know, in terms of how is Poland going to lead, you know, Europe, the faith into this new era that we kind of are sort of seeing has come to fruition to a certain degree. And so, like, during this time, what we'll see is we'll have, like, many Polish romanticists, you know, they are also seeing what's going on in Poland. They're recognizing the suffering. And so they saw a great place in history for Poland. And so, again, they would lead Europe to glory and the church. And so we'll look at certain philosophers and romanticists. So one of the big names that we'll highlight here is Adam Mickiewicz. So Adam Mickiewicz is essentially what he would do is he would take his style of writing and romanticism and he would take from the New Testament. And then one of his quotes he would say is here, "And on the third day, the soul will return to the body and the nation will rise up from the dead and liberate all peoples of Europe from captivity. And just as bloody sacrifices on earth came to an end with the resurrection of Christ, so wars and Christianity will cease with the resurrection of the Polish nation." So again, they just have this high nationalistic understanding of Poland's role in terms of restoration. But restoration to them can mean many things. Their ideology was that it wasn't going to just be Catholics that were going to bring about this great new understanding of the faith, but it was going to be Catholics who were going to be united with Protestants, who were going to be united with some of our quote-unquote Jewish brethren, as he likes to put it. So it sort of lays the ground for some of the ecumenical dialogue that we see. You know, like, well, we're all Christians, we're all humans, we're all people. You know, how can we unite to bring about a new faith, a new ideology? And so that's essentially Polish messianism in like a nutshell to a certain degree. And so we could go into a bunch of like some of his other quotes from Adam Mickiewicz. So another one he has here is, "And Poland said, whoever will come to me shall be free and equal, for I am freedom," right? This is where this whole notion of freedom as being the ultimate good is kind of coming into the periphery again, which we'll see continuing on in the Vatican II Church. Freedom is the point.
So we can kind of talk a little bit. So I really want to dig into that, you know, with tie into, you know, the errors of Americanism. I think we've talked about that privately of the how Americanism is just not talked about a lot or enough or really understood. But it's like the freedom, you know, Thomas Jefferson wanted to make his own religion based on like the loving of America, the worshiping of America. The freedom, Jerome brought up in the last episode with America Reform, that if the First Amendment really is just like a nail in the coffin of America ever being a Catholic nation, because if all things are true, then nothing's true.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And there seems to be a lot of parallels between, you know, Polish Messianism and like the Americanism, the freedom of you know, the freedom of democracy, however you want to word it.
Yeah, and that's another big aspect to bring about too, is that, you know, some of these romantic authors during this time in Poland, you know, they had some secret society ties. I believe it was Adam Toyanowski, who is the next gentleman I was going to address. But yeah, he had roles in the Filaris and the Philomaths. And again, it's just like a secret society in Poland, but, you know, seemingly they had some tie-ins to Freemasonry. You know, this obviously, you know, shortly after, you know, the French Revolution, you know, liberty, equality, and fraternity, you know, this is about liberty and freedom. Is the ultimate good that can bring about change. So that's kind of the big connecting thread too, is like, okay, who are these other people and who are they being influenced by? And yeah, we could argue it's Freemasonry. We could argue, you know, there's a good thread there in terms of that being connected to Kabbalistic Jews. In terms of, you know, contradictory things can also be true at the same time.
And, well, I mean, and that's the entire Talmud is just, yeah.
And we see that today, even with Vatican II, you know, like we can go to many of the writings before Vatican II. They're very doctrinal, very firm, you know, I would say easily understood if you haven't read any of the encyclicals, but, you know, they're condemning these things. But nowadays, or even books, you know, like one of my favorite books is Liberalism is a Sin. But nowadays, you can also be a liberal and a Catholic, seemingly at the same time. They don't oppose one another, right? And that's where, again, you get into that ideology of separation of church and state, you know, which has become the quote-unquote democratic ideal, because we'll let the secular authorities decide. You know, they're seemingly neutral, right? that's essentially what they want you to believe, but there is no neutrality. You know, that's one of the phrases I like to use, and another good friend of ours will use too. It's this myth of neutrality. There is nothing neutral, because if you're denigrating or subverting or putting religion lower in the sphere of things, that's clearly against religion. That's not neutral. Thinking a secular state is neutral is a lie. But it's a lie that many liberal people have accepted today, unfortunately.
Even you know, we're using, you know, liberal in a broad sense, but also, you know, the average conservative. This is his bread and butter is the Catholic con, as I heard on Substack somewhere the other day. The Catholic conservative is as insidious as he affirms all these beliefs, and which is something that needs to be purged from our the discussions. And it's, you know, I think understanding that, like, a lot of the duplicity of modern language comes from the Talmud, I think is a lot going to be a hard thing for a lot of people to swallow. And not everybody is, it's going to be a long, long time coming before, I don't know if I want to say that, but it's going to be a painful process to purge such these errors from our dialectic or our the public square.
Yeah, it's going to require some good philosophical principles. You know, I would argue it's going to require a return to scholastic thought, in terms of a thing is or is not. You know, it's not both, you know, in terms of being and becoming, right? So, like, a lot of the New Age religions and even the Vatican II Church is about what the church can become. You know, the Catholic Church is the road to heaven, but they'll also say it is also not, because, you know, some of these other religions have truths, so to say. You know, how can you say that they don't? That will be their argument. So it's a duplicitous nature, which again is firmly rooted in a liberal mindset. And I mean, we could even go all the way back to where did this liberal mindset start to take place? You know, we could go all the way back to nominalism. And then even stepping a little bit further forward, you know, I think the next step was, you know, Martin Luther. And then that's another thread too, in terms of, I think Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, he touched on Martin Luther and how he was influenced by Kabbalistic thinking, particularly with his five solas. In terms of how you can interpret the faith. But yeah, he has a good video on that too that I watched. It's probably got a good 4+ years ago, but it's always one I like to go back to, just in terms of, like, yeah, even Luther, you know, for his quote unquote condemnatory statements he had made against, you know, the Jewish people, he still had his influence from them even during his time. And that's also how he started to formulate his own ideas. And that was kind of one of the things. It was kind of funny. I was at a wedding today, and so we briefly mentioned Luther. And, you know, obviously Catholics, we believe in transubstantiation, right? Where the matter of the bread changes, you know, in terms into the body of Christ. But Lutherans, they believe in a co-substantiation. So the matter itself doesn't turn into Jesus itself, it can hold two natures at the same time, and they're not opposing one another. So that's kind of where they believe co-substantiation. So it's also bread, but it's also the body of Christ. And both of those and Luther's mindset are true. And Lutheran's mindset, that is true. But again, that's a duality. You know, these things they're in a state of, I don't want to say flux, but they can hold two points at the same time, which again, it goes against the laws of logic.
Well, and it, you know, it seems to be just mocking Christ, you know, him being man and God, you know, him holding that the ideal duality of existence it just seems like a mockery of Christ, and it's as much of the our spiritual elder brothers, to their chagrin, they put themselves in Christ, that they are the messiahs, that the goyim should worship them as the saviors of humanity.
Yeah, exactly. It's a duality that again is contrary to historical fact. You know, essentially, you know, they will invert scripture to their own needs to fit, you know, their current level of understanding. There's a good, I'm trying to find here, in terms of which, I think it's a writing from St. Peter, in terms of, you know, these people will turn the understanding of the New Testament to fit their own needs. And I mean, obviously that's what Protestantism has done. But again, that's also what the Novus Ordo Church has done too. You know, it's the focus is completely separated from the traditional historical thoughts of what all of the great saints believed and held for millennia.
I think it is, you know, it really kind of falls back on how much we need authority, how much we need to be told what to believe in, that, you know, our interpretation, you know, between, if we read the Bible, we could have two different interpretations, but, you know, we could look back on, you know, Chris Austin or Jerome and look at, or Augustine and look at their commentary and be like, okay, well, this is, you know, in line with authority. And I think that is the bane of liberalism. That is the bane of Talmudism. Is authority based in justice and truth? But you know, we're coming up. Do you have any final points that you'd like to make? I don't think Jerome's going to make it tonight.
Yeah, just to kind of hit a little bit more on this Polish Messianism. Like, that was very influential on John Paul II. Particularly there are some writings where, you know, he will highlight, you know, particularly when he became Pope himself, he self-referenced himself as the Slavic Pope. And so there's a romantic poet, during this 1830s, 1850s time of Polish Messianism, his name is Slowacki, and so he wrote a poem called Our Slavic Pope. And that was actually one of, like, the first things that John Paul II did, is he didn't necessarily announce himself as the Pope of the Universal Church, but he announced himself as a Slavic Pope, as a self-reference to this poem by Slowacki, you know, who was a Polish Messianist. And then even in this 1986, you know, obviously we can look at all of the post-Vatican II prelates, you know, many of them have unfortunately entered into a synagogue and prayed to their demons. But in 1986, you know, during his visit to a Roman synagogue, John Paul II, you know, he called the Jews our older brothers in faith, which is a term used by the Polish Messianist Mickiewicz. And so a lot of it, again, was brought to fruition, this Polis Messias idea. And John Paul II is the biggest representation of it. So now it's papal messianism, and it's brought about from a Polish person, right? A Polish pope. And so, again, he imbibed in that liberal ideology, the ecumenical understanding of what was going to bring about the new faith. It was going to be a conglomeration, you know, of Protestants, Jews, you know, obviously we see other religions too, who have, we have unfortunately began to dialogue with to increase our quote unquote understanding of God.
You know, I'm friends with some pagans, and there was a comment made that it seems like, this is quote me not being quoting them, not verbatim, but it seems like the Vatican will dialogue with anything but a white man. That only, they're not, they don't even dialogue with Freemasons, but they'll dialogue with like Aztec Mexicans, or you know, shamanistic Africans.
Yeah, and that's the point, and that's why traditional Catholics are shunned. You know, where, you know, you look at the demographics of the traditional Catholic. You know, I was just trying to look this up the other day, and depending where you go, it's 70 to 90%, you know, white. And so again, that's why the traditional movement has been shunned in that regards, because it's a representation of something that they want to step completely away from, you know, this doctrinal understanding of the faith, where it's rooted in firm, you know, scholastic principles. No, it needs to be opened up. And that's why they dialogue with Aztecs, with Mayans, with Hindus. You know, there's a new understanding that can happen, which again is, again, contrary to scholastic and true Catholic thought, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think we can wrap it up here. Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think the big thing we can sort of take away, because obviously, yeah, we could have went even more deep into Polish messianism, but yeah, it's just, how is Poland going to be this new Christ of Europe? And it was going to essentially bring about this new epoch and understanding of the faith. And so obviously that's rooted in phenomenological principles, in terms of it's all about experience. And these experiences, you know, can be contrary to another person's experience, yet still also true. And again, that's subjectivism. And that's essentially where we're at with the current Vatican II Church. It's about subjective understanding of the faith. And they don't understand, seemingly, I think they do understand, but they choose not to understand how that affects society and how that affects morals and how that affects, you know, everyone's day-to-day interactions. And again, it's a democratic turn rather than a hierarchical turn, you know, in terms of everything being equal. You can't have a hierarchy. That's not fair. That's white supremacy, you know, again, it goes back to white supremacy, unfortunately. And that's how, you know, they're largely stepping away from that, because it's not nice. It's not fair. It's not equal in man's terms. But again, heaven is not equal. It's a hierarchy. Even if and when we get to heaven, there's a hierarchy there, in terms of the seraphim, cherubim, you know, even the differing saints. You know, the merits you gain in this life will put you at a higher or lower place in heaven. You know, you're still in heaven is the point, but there's still a hierarchy. Like, we don't just name saints because, you know, oh, that was a good guy. And it's like, no, he was outstanding. He will lead you to the promised land, obviously, as if you follow Christ, but also these saints too. And that is why they are and should be highly regarded. But again, they're almost denying the greatness that have come from many of our saints and even in martyrs, of course, on top of it.
Yeah. And as Bishop Williamson affirmed, and we'll end with this, God creates inequality through all of his creation. But anyways, Arnold, thank you for coming back on. We can have you on and if, shortly. You know, God bless, sir.
Yep, God bless. Mary keep you.